He hated bigness per se. Bigness had destroyed the American system of free enterprise. The small businessman had been ruined. In fact, he himself had been perhaps the last authentic small businessman in the solar system. That was his real crime. He had tried to live the American way of life instead of just talking about it. "Screw them," he said to himself, seated on a crate, surrounded by boxes and cartons and packages and the workings of several dismantled rocket ships which he had been revamping. Outside the shed window, silent, desolate rock hills, with only a few shrubs, dried up and dying as far as the eye could see. And where was Norb Steiner right now? No doubt ensconced in some bar or restaurant or some woman's cheery living room, prattling his line, handing over tins of smoked salmon and getting in return. "Screw them all," Otto mumbled, getting up to pace back and forth. "If that's what they want, let them have it. Bunch of animals." Those Israeli girls. That's where Steiner was, with a kibbutz full of them. Those hot, black-eyed, heavy-lipped, big-breasted, sexy ones who got tanned, working out in the fields in shorts and cotton shirts, clinging to them. No bras, just those big, solid breasts. You could actually see their nipples because the damp fabric stuck to them. That's why he wouldn't let me go with him, Otto decided. The only women he ever saw out here in the FDR range were those stunted, black, dried-out Bleakman women. Not even human, at least not to him. He wasn't taken in by those anthropologists saying that the Bleakmen were from the same stock as Homo sapiens, that probably both planets were colonized 1 million years ago from one interplanetary race. Those toads? Human? Sleep with one of those? Christ, better to chop it off first. As a matter of fact, here came a party of Bleakmen right now, stepping gingerly with bare feet down the irregular rock surface of a northern hill. On their way here, Otto observed, as usual. He opened the door of the shed, waiting until they had reached him. 4 bucks, 2 of them elderly, 1 elderly woman, several skinny kids, carrying their bows, their pounding blocks, their paca eggshells. Halting, they regarded him silently, and then one of the bucks said, "Rains are falling from me onto your valuable person." "Likewise," Otto said, leaning against the shed and feeling dull, weighed down with hopelessness. "What do you want?" The Bleakman buck held out a small bit of paper, and Otto, taking it, saw that it was a label from a can of turtle soup. The Bleakman had eaten the soup, retaining the label for this purpose. They could not tell him what they wanted because they did not know what it was called. "Okay," he said. "How many?" He held up fingers. At 5, they nodded. 5 cans. "What you got?" Otto demanded, not stirring. One of the young Bleakman women stepped forward and pointed to that part of herself which had been so much in Otto's thoughts for so long. "Oh, Christ," Otto said in despair. "No, go on, beat it. Not anymore. I don't want any more." He turned his back on them, made his way into the storage shed, and slammed the door so hard that the shed walls trembled. He threw himself down on a packing crate, his head in his hands. "I'm going crazy," he said to himself, his jaw stiff, his tongue swelling up so that he could hardly talk. His chest ached. And then, to his amazement, he began to cry. "Jesus," he thought in fright, "I really am going crazy. I'm breaking down. Why?" Tears rolled down his cheeks. He hadn't cried in years. What's this all about? He wondered. His mind had no concept in it. It was only his body bawling away, and he was a spectator to it. But it brought him relief. With his handkerchief, he wiped his eyes, his face, and cursed when he saw that his hands were claw-like with rigidity, the fingers writhing. Outside the window of the shed, the Bleakman remained, perhaps seeing him. He could not tell. Their faces showed no expression, but he felt sure that they must have seen, and probably were as perplexed as he. "It sure is a mystery," he thought. "I agree with you." The Bleakman gathered together in a huddle and conferred, and one of them detached himself from the group and approached the shed. Otto heard a rap on the door. Going over to it and opening it, he found the young Bleakman standing there holding out something. "This, then," the young Bleakman said. Otto took it, but for the life of him he could not make out what it was. It had glass and metal to it and calibrations. And then he realized that it was an instrument used in surveying. On its side was stamped UN property. "I don't want it," he said irritably, turning it over and over. The Bleakman must have stolen it, he realized. He handed it back. The young buck accepted it stoically and returned to his group. Otto shut the door. This time they went off. He watched them through the window as they trailed away up the side of the hill. Steal you blind, he said to himself. Anyway, what was a UN survey company doing in the FDR range? To cheer himself up, he rummaged around until he found a can of smoked frog's legs. Opening it, he sat eating morosely, not getting from the dainty anything at all, and yet methodically finishing the can. Into the microphone, Jack Boland said, "Don't send me, Mr. Yee. I already ran into Cot today and defended him." Weariness settled over him. Naturally, I ran into Cot for the first time in my life, and naturally I insulted him, he thought to himself. And just as naturally, because that's how my life works, it's the same day that Arnie Cot decides to call up Yee Company and ask for service. It's typical of the little game I play with the powerful, inanimate forces of life. "Mr. Cot mentioned meeting you on the desert," Mr. Yee said. "In fact, his decision to call us was based on that meeting." "The hell you say?" He was dumbfounded. "I do not know what the issue was, Jack, but no harm has been done. Direct your ship to Lewistown. If you run over beyond 5 o'clock, you will be paid time and a half. And Mr. Cot, who is known as a generous man, is so anxious to have his encoder working that he promises to see that you receive a bountiful meal." "All right," Jack said. It was too much for him to dope out. After all, he knew nothing of what went on in Arnie Cot's mind. Not long thereafter, he was lowering his copter to the roof parking lot of the Waterworkers Union Hall at Lewistown. A slavey sauntered out and regarded him suspiciously. "Yee Company repairman," Jack said. "Call put in by Arnie Cot." "Okay, buddy," the slavey said, and led him to the elevator. He found Arnie Cot in a well-furnished Earth-type living room. The big bald-headed man was on the telephone, and he nodded his head at Jack's appearance. The nod indicated the desk on which a portable encoding dictation machine sat. Jack walked over to it, removed the lid, turned it on. Meanwhile, Arnie Cot continued his phone conversation. "Sure I know it's a tricky talent. Sure there's a good reason why nobody's been able to make use of it. But what am I supposed to do, give up and pretend it don't exist just because people have been too dumb for 50,000 years to take it seriously? I still want to try it." A long pause. "Okay, Doctor, thanks." Arnie hung up. To Jack, he said, "You ever been to Camp BG?" "No," Jack said. He was busy opening up the encoder. Arnie strolled over and stood beside him. As he worked, Jack could feel the astute gaze fixed on him. It made him nervous, but there was nothing he could do except try to ignore the man and go on. A little like the master circuit, he thought to himself. And then he wondered, as he often did, if he was going to have another one of his spells. True, it had been a long time, but here was a powerful figure looming close to him, scrutinizing him, and it did feel somewhat like that old interview with Corona's personnel manager. "That was Glaub on the phone," Arnie Cot said. "The psychiatrist. You ever heard of him?" "No," Jack said. "What do? Live your life entirely with your head stuck in the back of machines?" Jack looked up, met the man's gaze. "I've got a wife and son. That's my life. What I'm doing right now is a means of keeping my family going." He spoke calmly. Arnie did not seem to take offense. He even smiled. "Something to drink?" Arnie asked. "Coffee if you have it." "I've got authentic home coffee," Arnie said. "Black?" "Black." "Yeah, you look like a black coffee man. You think you can fix that machine right here and now, or are you going to have to take it with you?" "I can fix it here." Arnie beamed. "That's swell. I really depend on that machine." "Where's the coffee?" Turning, Arnie went off dutifully. He rustled about in another room and then returned with a ceramic coffee mug, which he set down on the desk near Jack. "Listen, Boland, I have a person coming here any minute now. A girl. It won't interfere with your work, will it?" Jack glanced up, supposing the man was being sarcastic. But evidently not. Arnie was eyeing him and then the partly disassembled machine, obviously concerned with how the repair was progressing. "He certainly is dependent on this," Jack decided. Strange how people cling to their possessions, as if they're extensions of their bodies, a sort of hypochondria of the machine. You'd think a man like Arnie Cot could scrap this encoder and shell out the money for a new one. There sounded a knock on the door, and Arnie hurried to open it. "Oh, hi," his voice came to Jack. "Come on in. Hey, I'm getting my doodad fixed." A girl's voice said, "Arnie, you'll never get your doodad fixed." Arnie laughed nervously. "Hey, meet my new repairman, Jack Boland. Boland, this is Doreen Underton, our union treasurer." "Hi," Jack said. Out of the corner of his eye, he did not stop working. He could see that she had red hair and extremely white skin and large, wonderful eyes. "Everybody's on the payroll," he thought tartly. "What a great world. What a great union you've got going here for yourself, Arnie."
"Busy, isn't he?" the girl said.
"Oh, yeah," Arnie agreed. "These repair guys are bugs on getting the job done right. I mean these outside guys, not our own. Ours are a bunch of slobs that sit around playing with themselves at our expense. I'm through with them, Dor. I mean, this guy Bolin is a whiz. He's going to have the encoder working any minute now, aren't you, Jack?"
"Yeah," Jack said.
The girl said, "Don't you say hello, Jack?" Halting his work, he turned his attention on her. He faced her levelly. Her expression was cool and intelligent, with a faintly mocking quality which was peculiarly rewarding and annoying.
"Hello," Jack said.
"I saw your copter on the roof," the girl said.
"Let him work," Arnie said peevishly. "Give me your coat." He stood behind her, helping her out of her coat. The girl wore a dark wool suit, obviously an import from Earth, and therefore expensive to an appalling degree.
"I'll bet that set the union pension fund back plenty," Jack decided.
Observing the girl, he saw in her a vindication of a piece of old wisdom. Nice eyes, hair, and skin produced a pretty woman, but a truly excellent nose created a beautiful woman. This girl had such a nose, strong, straight, dominating her features, forming a basis for her other features. Mediterranean women reached the level of beauty much more easily than, say, Irish or English women, he realized, because, genetically speaking, the Mediterranean nose, whether Spanish or Hebrew or Turkish or Italian, played a naturally greater part in physiognomic organization. His own wife Sylvia had a gay, turned-up Irish nose. She was pretty enough by any standard, but there was a difference. He guessed that Doreen was in her early 30s, and yet she possessed a freshness that gave her a stable quality. He had seen such clear coloration in high school girls approaching nubility, and once in a long while one saw it in 50-year-old women who had perfect gray hair and wide, lovely eyes. This girl would still be attractive 20 years from now, and probably had always been so. He could not imagine her any other way. Arnie, by investing in her, had perhaps done well with the funds entrusted to him. She would not wear out. Even now he saw a maturity in her face, and that among women was rare. Arnie said to him, "We're going out and have a drink. If you get that machine fixed in time..." "It's fixed now." He had found the broken belt and had replaced it with one from his toolkit.
"Good deal,"
Arnie said, grinning like a happy child.
"Then come on along with us."
To the girl he explained, "We're meeting Milton Glaub, the famous psychiatrist. You probably heard of him. He promised to have a drink with me. I was just talking to him on the phone just now, and he sounds like a top-notch sort of guy."
He whacked Jack loudly on the shoulder.
"I bet when you landed your copter on the roof, you didn't think you'd be having a drink with one of the solar system's best-known psychoanalysts, did you?"
"I wonder if I should go along," Jack thought. "But why not?"
He said, "Okay, Arnie." Arnie said, "Doc Glaub is going to scare up a schizophrenic for me. I need one. I need its professional services."
He laughed, eyes twinkling, finding his own utterance outstandingly funny.
"Do you?" Jack said. "I'm a schizophrenic."
Arnie stopped laughing.
"No kidding. I never would have guessed. What I mean is you look all right."
Finishing up the task of putting the encoder back together, Jack said, "I am all right. I'm cured."
Doreen said, "No one is ever cured of schizophrenia."
Her tone was dispassionate. She was simply stating a fact.
"They can be," Jack said, "if it's what's called situational schizophrenia."
Arnie eyed him with great interest, even suspicion.
"You're pulling my leg. You're just trying to worm your way into my confidence."
Jack shrugged, feeling himself flush. He turned his attention back completely to his work.
"No offense," Arnie said. You really are? No kidding? Listen, Jack, let me ask you, do you have any sort of ability or power to read the future?"
After a long pause, Jack said, "No."
"You sure?" Arnie said with suspicion.
"I'm sure."
He wished now that he had turned down flat that invitation to accompany them. The intent questioning made him feel exposed. Arnie was nudging too close, encroaching on him. It was difficult to breathe, and Jack moved around to the far side of the desk to put more distance between himself and the plumber.
"What's the matter?" Arnie asked acutely.
"Nothing."
Jack continued working, not looking at either Arnie or the girl. Both of them were watching him, and his hands shook. Presently, Arnie said, "Jack, let me tell you how I got where I am."
One talent got me up here. I can judge people and tell what they're like down inside, what they really are, not just what they do and say. I don't believe you. I bet you're lying to me about your precognition. Isn't that right? You don't even have to answer. Turning to the girl, Arnie said, "Let's get ballin'. I want that drink." He beckoned to Jack to follow. Laying down his tools, Jack reluctantly did so. Chapter 7. On his journey by copter to Lewistown to meet Arnie Cott and have a drink with him, Dr. Milton Glaub asked himself if his good luck were true. "I can't believe it," he thought, "a turning point in my life like this." He was not certain what Arnie wanted. The phone call had been so unexpected, and Arnie had talked so fast that Dr. Glaub had wound up perplexed, knowing only that it had to do with parapsychological aspects of the mentally ill. Well, he could tell Arnie practically all there was to know on that topic. And yet Glaub sensed that there was something deeper in the inquiry. Generally, a concern with schizophrenia was a symptom of a person's own inner struggle in that area. Now, it was a fact that often the first signs of the insidious growth of the schizophrenic process in a person was an inability to eat in public. Arnie had noisily gabbed on about his desire to meet Glaub, not in his own home or in the doctor's office, but at a well-known bar and restaurant in Lewistown, the Willows. Was this perhaps a reaction formation? Mysteriously made tense by public situations, and especially by those involving the nutritive function, Arnie Cott was leaning over backward to regain the normalcy which was beginning to abandon him. Piloting his copter, Glaub thought about this, but then, by slow and stealthy stages, his thinking returned to the topic of his own problems. Arnie Cott, a man controlling a multi-million-dollar union fund, a prominent person in the colonial world, although virtually unknown back home, a feudal baron, virtually. "If Cott were to put me on his staff," Glaub speculated, "I could pay off all the debts we've piled up, those hideous charge account bills at 20% interest that just seem to loom there always, never getting smaller or going away. And then we could start over, not go into debt, live within our means, and a highly expanded means at that." Then, too, old Arnie was a Swede or a Dane, something like that, so it wouldn't be necessary for Glaub to season his skin color before receiving each patient. Plus the fact that Arnie had a reputation for informality. Milt and Arnie, it would be. Dr. Glaub smiled. What he had to be sure to do in this initial interview was to ratify Arnie's concepts, sort of play along and not dash cold water on things, even if, say, old Arnie's notions were way out of line. A hell of a thing it would be to discourage the man. That wasn't right. "I see your point, Arnie," Dr. Glaub said to himself, practicing away as he piloted his copter closer and closer to Lewistown. "Yes, there is a good deal to be said for that worldview." He had handled so many types of social situations for his patients, appearing in public for them, representing those timid, shut-in schizoid personalities who shrank from interpersonal exposure, that this would undoubtedly be a snap. And, if the schizophrenic process in Arnie were beginning to bring up its heavy artillery, Arnie might need to lean on him for his very survival. "Hot dog," Dr. Glaub said to himself, and increased the velocity of the copter to its maximum. Around the Willows ran a moat of cold blue water. Fountains sprayed water into the air, and bougainvillea, purple and amber and rusty red, grew to great heights, encircling the single-story glass structure. As he descended the black wrought-iron staircase from the parking lot, Dr. Glaub perceived his party within. Arnie Cott, seated with a stunning redhead and nondescript male companion wearing a repairman's overalls and canvas shirt. "True classless society here," Dr. Glaub reflected. A rainbow-style bridge assisted him in his crossing of the moat. Doors opened before him. He entered the lounge, passed by the bar, halted to sniff in the sight of the jazz combo, composing meditatively, and then hailed Arnie. "Hi, Arnie!" "Hi, Doc!" Arnie rose to introduce him. "Dor, this is Doc Glaub, Doreen Anderton. This is my repairman, Jack Bolin, a real fireballer. Jack, this is the foremost living psychiatrist, Milt Glaub." They all nodded and shook hands. "Hardly foremost," Glaub murmured as they sat down. "It's still the Swiss at Bergholzlei, the existential psychiatrists who dominate the field." But he was deeply gratified, untrue as Arnie's announcement had been. He could feel his face flushing with pleasure. "Sorry it took me so long to get here. I had to dash over to New Israel. Bosley Tuvin, needed my advice on a medical matter which he considered pressing.
Quite a guy, that Boz, Arnie said.
He had lit a cigar, a genuine earth-rolled Optimo Admiral.
A real go-getter. But let's get down to business.
Wait, I'll get you a drink. He looked inquiringly at Glaub while waving the cocktail waitress over.
A scotch, if you have it, Glaub said.
Cutty sack, sir, the waitress said.
Oh, fine. No ice, please.
Okay, Arnie said impatiently. Now look, Doc, you got the name of a really advanced schizo for me or not?
He scrutinized Glaub.
Said Glaub, and then he recalled his visit to New Israel not more than a short while ago.
Manfred Steiner, he said.
Any relation to Norbert Steiner?
As a matter of fact, his boy. It can't be G. Oh, I imagine there's no breach of confidence in telling you.
Totally autistic from birth. Mother, the cold, intellectual, schizoid personality, doing it by the rule book.
Father dead, Arnie said shortly.
Right. Very regrettable. Nice chap, but depressive. It was suicide, you know. Typical impulse during his low swing. A wonder he didn't do it years ago.
Arnie said, "You told me on the phone you've got a theory about the schizophrenic being out of phase in time."
"Yes, it's a derangement in the interior time sense."
Dr. Glaub had all three of them listening, and he warmed to his topic. It was his favorite.
"We have yet to get total experimental verification, but that will come."
And then, without hesitation or shame, he passed off the Bergholtzli theory as his own. Evidently much impressed, Arnie said, "Very interesting." To the repairman, Jack Bolin, he said, "Could such slow-motion chambers be built?"
"No doubt," Jack murmured.
"And sensors," Glaub said, "to get the patient out of the chamber and into the real world. Sight, hearing."
"It could be done," Bolin said.
"How about this?" Arnie said impatiently and enthusiastically. "Could the schizophrenic be running so fast compared to us in time that he's actually in what to us is the future? Would that account for his precognition?"
His light-colored eyes glittered excitedly.
Glaub shrugged in a manner indicating agreement. Turning to Bolin, Arnie stuttered,
Hey, Jack! That's it! God damn it, I ought to be a psychiatrist.
Slow him down, hell, speed him up, I say. Let him live out of phase in time if he wants to. But let's get him to share his perceptions with us. Right, Bolin?
Glaub said, "Now, there is the rub. In autism, especially, the faculty of interpersonal communication is drastically impaired."
"I see," Arnie said, but he was not daunted.
"Hell, I know enough about that to see a way out. Didn't that early guy, Carl Jung, didn't he manage to decode the schizophrenic's language years ago?"
"Yes," Glaub said. "Decades ago, Jung cracked the private language of the schizophrenic. But in child autism, as with Manfred, there is no language at all. At least no spoken language. Possibly totally personal private thoughts, but no words."
"Shit," Arnie said.
The girl glanced at him admonishingly.
"This is a serious matter," Arnie said to her. "We've got to get these unfortunates, these autistic kids, to talk to us and tell us what they know. Isn't that right, Doc?"
"Yes," Glaub said.
"That kid's an orphan now," Arnie said.
"That Manfred."
"Well, he has the mother still," Glaub said.
Waving his hand excitedly, Arnie said,
"Yeah, but they don't care enough about the kid to have him at home. They junked him in that camp. Hell, I'll spring him and bring him here. And Jack, you get on this and engineer a machine to make contact with him. You see the picture?"
After a moment, Bolin said, "I don't know what to say."
He laughed briefly.
"Sure you know what to say. Hell, it ought to be easy for you. You're a schizophrenic yourself, like you said."
Glaub, interested, said to Bolin, "Is that the case?"
He had already noted automatically the repairman's skeletal tension as he sat sipping his drink and the rigid musculature, not to mention the asthenic build.
"But you appear to have made enormous strides toward recovery."
Raising his head, Bolin met his glance, saying, "I'm totally recovered. For many years now." His face was affect-laden. No one makes a total recovery, Glaub thought, but he did not say it. Instead, he said,
"Perhaps Arnie is right. You could empathize with the autistic, whereas that is our basic problem. The autistic can't take our roles, see the world as we do, and we can't take his role either, so a gulf separates us."
"Bridge that gulf, Jack," Arnie cried. He whacked Bolin on the back. "That's your job. I'm putting you on the payroll." Envy filled Dr. Glaub. He glared down at his drink, hiding his reaction. The girl, however, saw it and smiled at him. He did not smile back. Contemplating Dr. Glaub sitting opposite him, Jack Bolan felt the gradual diffusion of his perception, which he so dreaded, the change in his awareness which had attacked him this way years ago in the personnel manager's office at Corona Corporation, and which always seemed still with him, just on the edge. He saw the psychiatrist under the aspect of absolute reality, a thing composed of cold wires and switches, not a human at all, not made of flesh. The fleshy trappings melted and became transparent, and Jack Bolan saw the mechanical device beyond. Yet he did not let his terrible state of awareness show. He continued to nurse his drink. He went on listening to the conversation and nodding occasionally. Neither Dr. Glaub nor Arnie Kott noticed. But the girl did. She leaned over and said softly in Jack's ear, "Aren't you feeling well?" He shook his head. "No," he was saying, "I'm not feeling well."
"Let's get away from them," the girl whispered. "I can't stand it either."
Aloud to Arnie, she said, "Jack and I are going to leave you two alone. Come on." She tapped Jack on the arm and rose to her feet. He felt her light, strong fingers, and he too rose. Arnie said, "Don't be gone long," and resumed his earnest conversation with Dr. Glaub. "Thanks," Jack said as they walked up the aisle between tables. Doreen said, "Did you see how jealous he was when Arnie said he was putting you on the payroll?" "No, Glaub?" But he was not surprised. "I get this way," he said to the girl by way of apology. "Something to do with my eyes. It may be astigmatism, due to tension." The girl said, "Do you want to sit at the bar or go outside?" "Outside," Jack said. Presently they stood on the Rainbow Bridge over the water. In the water fish slid about, luminous and vague, half-real beings, as rare on Mars as any form of matter conceivable. They were a miracle in this world, and Jack and the girl, gazing down, both felt it. And both knew they felt this same thought without having to speak it aloud.
"It's nice out here," Doreen said finally.
"Yeah." He did not want to talk.
"Everybody," Doreen said, "has at one time or another known a schizophrenic, if they're not one themselves. It was my brother back home, my younger brother."
"I'll be okay," Jack said. "I'm okay now."
"But you're not," Doreen said.
"No," he admitted. "But what the hell can I do? You said it yourself. Once a schizophrenic, always a schizophrenic." He was silent then, concentrating on the gliding pale fish.
"Arnie thinks a lot of you," the girl said. "When he says his talent is judging the value of people, he's telling the truth. He can see already that that Glaub is desperately eager to sell himself and get on the staff here in Lewistown. I guess psychiatry doesn't pay any more as it once did. Too many in the business. There are 20 of them here in this settlement already, and none do a genuinely good traffic. Didn't your condition cause you trouble when you applied for permission to emigrate?"
He said, "I don't want to talk about it, please."
"Let's walk," the girl said.
They walked along the street, past the shops, most of which had closed for the day.
"What was it you saw," the girl said, "when you looked at Dr. Glaub there at the table?"
Jack said, "Nothing."
"You'd rather not say about that either."
"That's right."
"Do you think if you tell me things will get worse?"
"It's not things, it's me."
"Maybe it is the things," Doreen said. "Maybe there is something in your vision, however distorted and garbled it's become. I don't know. I used to try like hell to comprehend what it was Clay, my brother, saw and heard. He couldn't say. I know that his world was absolutely different from the rest of ours in the family. He killed himself like Steiner did."
She had paused at a newsstand to look over the item on page one about Norbert Steiner.
"The existential psychiatrists often say to let them go ahead and take their lives. It's the only way for some of them. The vision becomes too awful to bear."
Jack said nothing.
"Is it awful?" Doreen asked.
"No, just disconcerting." He struggled to explain. "There's no way you can work it in with what you're supposed to see and know. It makes it impossible to go on in the accustomed way."
"Don't you very often try to pretend and sort of go along with it by acting like an actor?"
When he did not answer, she said, "You tried to do that in there just now."
"I'd love to fool everybody," he conceded. "I'd give anything if I could go on acting it out, playing a role. But that's a real split. There's no split up until then. They're wrong when they say it's a split in the mind. If I wanted to keep going entire without a split, I'd have to lean over and say to Dr. Glaub... He broke off.
Tell me, the girl said.
Well, he said, taking a deep breath, I'd say, Doc, I can see you under the aspect of eternity, and you're dead.
That's the substance of the sick, morbid vision. I don't want it. I didn't ask for it.
The girl put her arm within his. I've never told anyone before, Jack said. Not even Sylvia, my wife, or my son David. You know, I watch him. I look every day to be sure it isn't showing up in him, too. It's so easy for this stuff to get passed along, as with the Steiners. I didn't know they had a boy at BG until Glaub said so. And they're neighbors of ours for years back. Steiner never let it out.
Doreen said, We're supposed to go back to the Willows for dinner. Do you want to? I think it would be a good idea.
You know, you don't have to join Arnie's staff. You can stay with Mr. Yee. That's a nice copter you have. You don't have to give all that up just because Arnie decides he can use you. Maybe you can't use him.
Shrugging, he said, It's an interesting challenge, building a conduit for communication between an autistic child and our world. I think there's a lot in what Arnie says. I could be the intermediary. I could do a useful job there.
It doesn't really matter why Arnie wants to bring out the Steiner boy, he realized. Probably he's got some solid selfish motive, something that will bring him a profit in cold hard cash. I certainly couldn't care less.
In fact, I can have it both ways, he realized.
Mr. Yee can lease me to the Water Workers Union. I'd be paid by Mr. Yee and he'd be paid by Arnie. Everyone would be happy, and why not? Tinkering with the broken, malfunctioning mind of a child certainly has more to recommend it than tinkering with refrigerators and encoders. If the child is suffering some of the visions that I know. He knew of the time theory which Glaub had trotted out as his own. He had read about it in Scientific American. Naturally, he read anything on schizophrenia that he could get his hands on. He knew that it had originated with the Swiss, that Glaub hadn't invented it. What an odd theory it is, he thought to himself. And yet it rings true.
Let's go back to the Willows, he said.
He was very hungry, and it would no doubt be a bang-up meal.
Doreen said, You're a brave person, Jack Bolin.
Why? He asked.
Because you're going back to the place that troubled you, to the people that brought on your vision of, as you said, eternity. I wouldn't do that, I'd flee.
But, he said, that's the whole point. It's designed to make you flee. The vision's for that purpose, to nullify your relations with other people, to isolate you. If it's successful, your life with human beings is over. That's what they mean when they say the term schizophrenia isn't a diagnosis, it's a prognosis. It doesn't say anything about what you have, only about how you'll wind up.
And I'm not going to wind up like that, he said to himself, like Manfred Steiner, mute, and in an institution. I intend to keep my job, my wife and son, my friendships.
He glanced at the girl holding onto his arm.
And yes, even love affairs, if such there be.
I intend to keep trying.
Putting his hands in his pockets as he walked along, he touched something small, cold, and hard. Lifting it out in surprise, he saw it was a wrinkled little object, like a tree root.
What in the world's that? Doreen asked him.
It was the water witch which the Bleakman had given him that morning out in the desert. He had forgotten all about it.
A good luck charm, Jack said to the girl.
Shivering, she said, It's awfully ugly.
Yes, he agreed, but it's friendly. And we do have this problem, we schizophrenics. We do pick up other people's unconscious hostility.
I know, the telepathic factor. Clay had it worse and worse until...
She glanced at him. The paranoid outcome.
It's the worst thing about our condition, this awareness of the buried, repressed sadism and aggression in others around us, even strangers. I wish to hell we didn't have it. We even pick it up from people in restaurants.
He thought of Glaub.
In buses, in a theater, crowds.
Doreen said, Do you have any idea what Arnie wants to learn from the Steiner boy?
Well, this theory about precognition.
But what does Arnie want to know about the future?
You have no idea, do you? And it would never occur to you to try to find out.
That was so. He had not even been curious.
You're content, she said slowly, scrutinizing him. Merely to do your technical task of rigging up the essential machinery.
That's not right, Jack Bolin. That's not a good sign at all.
Oh, he said. He nodded. It's very schizophrenic, I guess, to be content with a purely technical relationship. Will you ask Arnie? He felt uncomfortable. It's his business, not mine. It's an interesting job, and I like Arnie. I prefer him to Mr. Yi. I just haven't got it in me to pry. That's the way I am. I think you're afraid, but I don't see why. You're brave, and yet in some deep way you're terribly, terribly frightened. Maybe so, he said, feeling sad. Together they walked on back to the willows. That night, after everyone had gone, including Doreen Anderton, Arnie Kott sat alone in his living room, gloating. What a day it had been. He had snared a good repairman who had already repaired his invaluable encoder, and who was going to build an electronic wingding to tap the precog faculties of an autistic child. He had milked for nothing the information he needed from a psychiatrist, and then managed to get rid of the psychiatrist. So all in all, it had been an exceptional day. It left only two problems. His harpsichord was still untuned, and what the hell else? It had slipped his mind. He pondered as he sat before his TV set, watching the fights from America the Beautiful, the USA colony on Mars. Then he remembered Norb Steiner's death. There was no source of goodies anymore. I'll fix that, Arnie said aloud. He shut off the TV and got his encoder out. Seated before it, mic in hand, he delivered a message. It was to Scott Temple, with whom he had worked on countless important business ventures. Temple was a cousin of Ed Rockingham and a good egg to know. He had managed, through a charter arrangement with the UN, to gain control of most of the medical supplies entering Mars, and what a top-notch monopoly that amounted to. The drums of the encoder turned encouragingly. Scott, Arnie said, how are you? Hey, you know that poor guy Norb Steiner? Too bad, I mean, he's dying and all. I understand he was mentally you-know-what, like the rest of us. Arnie laughed at that long and hard. So anyhow, it leaves us with a little problem. I mean, one of procurement, right? So listen, Scott, old man, I'd like to talk it over with you. I'm in. You get me? Stop by here in around a day or two so we can work out the exact arrangements. I think we should forget the gear that Steiner was using. We'll start out fresh, get our own little bitty field in an out-of-the-way place, our own slave rockets, whatever else we need. Keep those smoked oysters rolling in like they ought to. He shut the machine off and tried to think if there was more. No, he had said it all. Between him and a man like Scott Temple, no more had to be said. It was a deal then and there. Okay, Scott boy, he said, I'll expect to see you. After he had removed the spool, it occurred to him to play it back just to be sure it had gone into code. God, what a calamity if by some freak chance it came out in clear. But it was in code, all right, and his dearest. The machine had put the semantics units into a catfight-like parody of contemporary electronic music. Arnie, hearing the whistles, growls, beeps, hoots, hums, laughed until tears ran down his cheeks. He had to go off to the bathroom and slap cold water on his face to stop himself. Then, back at the encoder, he carefully marked the box into which the spool went. Song of the Wind Spirit, a cantata, by Carl William Dittershand. That composer, Carl William Dittershand, was the current favorite back on Earth among the intellectuals, and Arnie detested the man's electronic so-called music. He was a purist himself. His tastes stopped firmly at Brahms. Arnie had a good laugh at that, marking his encoded message, proposing his and Scott's going into the black market importation of foodstuffs as a cantata by Dittershand, and then rang up a Union Good member to convey the spool up north to Nova Britannica, the UK colony on Mars. That, at 8:30 in the evening, wound up the business of the day, and Arnie returned to his TV set to see the finish of the fights. He lit himself another Optimo Extra Mild Admiral, leaned back, broke wind, relaxed. I wish all days could be like this, he said to himself. I could live forever if they were. Days like this made him younger, not older. He felt as if he could see 40 come by again. Imagine me going into the black market, he said to himself. And for little stuff. Little tins of wild blackberry jelly and slices of pickled eel and lox. But that was vital, too, for him especially. Nobody is going to rob me of my treats, he thought grimly. If that Steiner thought by killing himself he could cut me off where it hurts. Come on, he urged the colored boy, taking a licking on the TV screen. Get up, you bugger, and give it to him. As if he had heard, the Negro fighter scrambled back up, and Arnie Kott chuckled with deep, keen pleasure. In the small hotel room where he traditionally stayed weekend nights in Bunchwood Park when on call,
Jack Bolin sat by the window, smoking a cigarette and pondering. It had returned after all these years, that which he dreaded. He had to face it. Now it was not anguished anticipation, it was actuality. Christ, he thought miserably, they're right. Once you have it, you've got it for keeps. The visit to the public school had set him up for it, and at the Willows it had appeared and smitten him, as intact and full as if he were in his 20s again, back on Earth, working for Corona Corporation down in Redwood City. And I know, he thought, that Norbert Steiner's death figured into it. Death upsets everyone, makes them do peculiar things. It sets a radiating process of action and emotion going that works its way out, farther and farther, to embrace more people and things. Better call Sylvia, he thought, and see how she's making out with Frau Steiner and the children. But he shrank from it. There's nothing I can do to help anyhow, he decided. I have to be on 24-hour call here in town, where Mr. Yee's switchboard can get hold of me. And now, too, he had to be available to Arnie Kott at Lewistown. There had, however, been compensation. A fine, deep, subtle, highly invigorating compensation. In his wallet he had Doreen Anderton's address and phone number. Should he call her tonight? Imagine, he thought, finding someone, a woman too, with whom he could talk freely, who understood about his situation, who genuinely wanted to hear and was not frightened. It helped a lot. His wife was the last person in the world he could talk to about his schizophrenia. On the few occasions he had tried, she had simply collapsed with fear. Like everybody else, Sylvia was terrified at the idea of it entering her life. She herself warded it off with the magic charms of drugs, as if phenobarbital could halt the most pervasive, ominous psychic process known to man. God knew how many pills he himself had swallowed during the last decade, enough to pave a road from his home to this hotel and possibly back. He decided after some reflection not to call Doreen. Better to leave it as a way out when the going got exceptionally rough. Right now he felt fairly placid. There would be plenty of time in the future, and plenty of need to seek out Doreen Anderton. Of course he would have to be incredibly careful. Obviously Doreen was Arnie Kott's mistress. But she seemed to know what she was doing, and certainly she knew Arnie. She must have taken him into account when she gave out her phone number and address, and for that matter when she got up and left the restaurant. I trust her, Jack said to himself. And for someone with a streak of schizophrenia, that is something. Pondering that, Jack Bolin put out his cigarette, went and got his pajamas, and prepared to go to bed. He was just getting under the covers when the phone in his room rang.